And the court will proceed to the fifth case, Estremera versus the United States. Mr. Carson.
Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court, members of the court. As the court knows, I am attorney Chris Carson representing the appellant Ludwina Estremera. Ms. Estremera is an innocent store owner, a Mexican immigrant into Milwaukee. She had an employee who essentially committed food stamp fraud and redeemed food stamp coupons illegally six times. This employee essentially quit or absconded from Milwaukee and has fled the state and is nowhere to be found. My client, Ludwina Estremera, the store owner, because she lived and her store was in a poor Mexican immigrant area of Milwaukee, had no way to continue in business. Her store essentially went out of business as a practical matter. It had no further income to speak of because of the lack of food stamp redemption capability. She was disqualified by the federal government. She did not appeal that disqualification. What we have here, we brought suit and consented to appear before a magistrate judge, Judge William Callahan. Judge Callahan entertained motions for summary judgment and, as the court knows, procedurally granted summary judgment in favor of the government. We believe that decision was erroneously reached, and there are several reasons why. The first reason, and I think the simplest reason to explain, is that there is a factual dispute as to whether or not the store was sold. I don't believe there really is much of a dispute. I don't think it was sold, but for the sake of argument, let's assume that there is a factual dispute.
Yes. I need some help with that argument because does it really matter what the buyer's intention was? I mean, aren't we only concerned with the seller's intention?
Well, I think if
the seller intended to sell the store and entered into an agreement with that intention, having been informed that she would be penalized for such a transaction,
I think there has to be.
Unfortunately, isn't that enough?
I'm not so sure. I don't believe it is enough. I think there has to be a meeting of the minds. I mean, way back in law school, when we all read the restatement of contracts, there really has to be a meeting of the minds as to show whether or not a contract can be entered into, whether a valid enforceable contract can be deemed established. There may be intent. There may be various efforts to have a contract. Maybe even a subjective belief by one of the parties that there is a contract. But unless there's a true meeting of the minds, there is no contract. And what we have here is really a very poor sale, a poor attempt at a sale. But even more important than the bad faith of the buyer, I'm relying upon the argument that this was not this was akin to a land contract. And in land contract, the sale is really completed when title transfers, and that's when all the payments have been made. This was not a sale of real estate. This was a sale of a store, a business entity. So what we have is the store attempting to be sold, my client attempting to sell her store to Mr. Souza over a period of several years, according to a note. Those payments were breached pretty much at the outset. So Ms. Estremera essentially ends up with the store again. So that's the problem there. It's not simply a matter of the bad faith of Mr. Souza. It's also, and there was no meeting of the minds, it's also that the sale itself was aborted because it was aborted in mid-sale or at the beginning of the sale process. This is a multi-year sale. I don't want to get bogged down in that unless you have a follow-up question on that issue.
Well, there were these five payments, weren't there?
I think there were five or less, let's put it that way, payments. There were no more than five payments, to my knowledge.
Does she have a malpractice case against her first attorney? Mm-hmm.
I think she does. Ms. Estramera as I mentioned in my brief, I'm pretty much taking this as a pro bono case. She's very indigent. She doesn't have any money. If she has a malpractice case, and I believe she does, as I pointed out in the brief, because Mr. Safer, the attorney, actually drafted these documents and never advised her that there would be the potential of this transfer of ownership fee penalty. And she is a very unsophisticated person in terms of the law, obviously. So the other point to be made more centrally is that Judge Callahan attached, even if we assume, I apologize for my interruption, even if we assume that there was, in fact, a sale within the meaning of the statute, I think it's very fair to say that Judge Callahan applied a bad standard of law. He applied the arbitrary and capricious standard. And I really think that a line of cases, some of which I cite, apply a different standard and show that a different standard should be attached. There should be several other factors taken into consideration.
Judge Callahan didn't say the words de novo, but he said he reviewed all the evidence, right?
He said he reviewed
which
the evidence.
Which sounds in terms of de novo review, does it not, Mr. Carson?
Judge Callahan, the suit essentially was a de novo review of an administrative agency determination. So Judge Callahan did review the evidence as supplemented in the course of that trial phase. We never went to trial. We never had a chance to go to trial. Ms. Estramera never got her day in court. She just got ruled against on summary judgment. Really, the standard...
And the primary evidence she relied on was the affidavit that you put together, which almost sounded like almost an expert opinion, you know, when we look at, you know, rather than personal knowledge because you weren't there directly. Do you have a case that suggests that that was an appropriate...
Sure.
Appropriate evidence to consider?
Excuse me.
The district court should have considered it in that context?
Well, I believe that this own circuit in 1999...
Because, you know, just submitting the documents, the court can, you know, look and see what's missing in the documents, and then it can certainly be argued.
Certainly.
But, you know, you didn't really have personal knowledge of what occurred at that time.
I was not present. I was not her attorney at the time, of course. I did, however, talk to Ms. Estramera at length. I went talked to
right,
her accountant
her
at length.
Her affidavit wasn't submitted, right?
Her affidavit was not submitted.
Because she can certainly say what her lawyer said or did not say and comment on what her understanding was versus having it go through you.
I wanted to tell the court this. If I had to do it over, I probably would have had Ms. Estramera sign it herself or have Mr. Estramera draft an affidavit. But I don't think
it's appropriate for you. You can certainly draft an affidavit. Clearly, given her circumstances, we're most sympathetic to her you know, situation and appreciative that you're representing her like this pro bono. But certainly counsel can draft the affidavit and she signs it. That's pretty typical.
If I had to do it over again, I think I would have done that. I would have arranged that. But I still think my affidavit is just as good and in one limited respect even better because I had a chance to discuss matters in detail of the finances of the sale transaction with her accountant, Mr. Becerra.
He was available
through an affidavit. I essentially summarized
I understand.
My discussions
that's
in
what
this
I'm
affidavit.
Saying. It to me read more akin to like almost like an expert deposition you might take, you know, just
I think
analyzing the legal issues and that kind of thing. But, I'm glad that in the future you're going to have the actual people who were involved do the affidavit. That is a better practice.
We do have an affidavit from Ms. Estramera.
Yes. You do have an affidavit from Esther.
And that affidavit verifies that there's a sale.
That is true. She initially, when response to the request for admissions by Attorney Norishi and Berry, Ms. Estramera did reply that there was a sale. However, given her unsophisticated nature, she, and in the course of our discussions later, it emerged in good faith that in my opinion and in her opinion, it really wasn't a sale.
But you got a trial judge faced with on a motion for summary judgment.
These documents,
and we have, and I'm not questioning the good faith of your assessment. We have an attorney's assessment against that. That's a steep hill to climb in a summary judgment setting.
The summary judgment setting is a steep hill to climb, in my perspective, from the move-in's perspective, because, you know, they have to be in the light most favorable to the non-moving party.
Right. And the non-moving party has your assessment, right?
The non-moving party is my assessment and the assessment of Ms. Estramera. In my assessment, and I submitted a piece of evidence, the case law does allow an attorney to submit an affidavit.
Judge Williams correctly pointed out, there's no question, and I don't want to be understood to criticize your submission. It's your submission versus this weight of this documentation on the other side.
But I don't think you have to decide between competing affidavits. I think that's an issue for trial. Once you have competing affidavits, it becomes an issue for trial. It becomes a factual issue to dispute. It is not an issue for summary judgment.
We don't have anything from the person with firsthand knowledge, or any other evidence that offers proof that the store had been turned back over to her, and that's, the problem.
I believe that my affidavit, within the meaning of the rules, constitutes a version of firsthand knowledge. I mean, I was so invested in discovering, analyzing, collecting information from the different parties to this. But see,
I just think, in the future, I don't care how strongly you feel about that, you are not winning on that point. There is no case law that supports you on that. I mean, it's just you're getting information from people and then you rehashing it. It just doesn't cut it. Not for purposes of summary judgment, not firsthand knowledge.
I don't want to quarrel with the court. My client would not have really been in a position to interpret what her accountant had said and these legal documents. Right. But that's fine. I'm not going to quarrel with the court. But even if, and I don't mean to tax the court's patience, but even if there was a sale within the meaning of the statute, the government should have applied a less harsh standard than arbitrary and capricious. And even if it was an arbitrary and capricious standard. Yeah. It was still arbitrary and capricious because the purpose of that statute is to prevent people from getting out from under the disqualification by passing their store over to friends and relatives. This was not the case. She was an innocent store owner by everybody's agreement. And even if you accept the arbitrary and capricious standard, which I don't, nevertheless, that purpose is not served by punishing Ms. Estramera $66,000, which she doesn't have. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Carson. Ms. Warwick.
May it please the court, counsel. I know in the heat of discussion, my colleague failed to mention, because we had talked about this just before we came into court today, I was not the initiating AUSA on this case. So yesterday, as I was preparing for oral argument today, I was taking probably my fifth glance through the briefs, and I noted that attached to appellant's brief are, in fact, some of the transaction documents from the sale. I then went to the docket to find out where those transaction documents are located, and they're not. I know my colleague by no means meant to imply that he was adding things to the record by simply attaching them to his brief. We talked, it was an oversight, but this is a de novo review, and I just wanted to make clear to the court that for whatever reason, neither side submitted to the district court, the magistrate court, the administrative record. So those particular documents are not a part of the record before the magistrate court.
Talking about the magistrate for just a minute, because the underlying violations question was not before the magistrate, I don't understand something. I don't understand why he had the authority to review the amount of the penalty imposed for the violations
that
she had failed, to appeal. I mean, Is it your position that this matter should not have been before the magistrate, or do you think it was properly before him?
If what counsel, if what the petitioner was seeking under the regs was a review of the imposition of the civil monetary penalty, the regs provide for that review, a judicial review, under an arbitrary and capricious standard. So what the magistrate court, we believe, was empowered to do was two things. First of all, to make a determination, did in fact a sale occur? Once that determination's made, then the magistrate judge in this case was empowered under the regs to make the second determination, which was the imposition of the sale of the store in compliance with the regs in an arbitrary and capricious fashion? And he did both those things. He cannot look at, did the violations occur? Petitioner had an opportunity to appeal that decision and chose not to for whatever reason.
Well, if he doesn't have that, how does he have the authority to review the amount of the penalty imposed?
Well, I suppose, because the regs provide an arbitrary capricious. So, in a hypothetical, let's just say that the Food and Nutrition Service said, Ms. Estramera is a really, really bad person. We're going to ignore our regs, and Ms. Estramera, you're paying $100,000. That, I think, would probably be deemed arbitrary and capricious. It wasn't in compliance with the regs. It went beyond the six violations at $11,000 per violation, the $66,000 cap. So that would have to have some meaningful explanation to be beyond the arbitrary and capricious standard and how that was under that. So he can look at how what the total imposition of the penalty was, and was it arbitrary and capricious. It is exceedingly narrow, I grant you that. And this court also, when it looks at it, it's, again, exceedingly narrow. And the regs are pretty narrow on the imposition of the penalty. It provides for the formula how to do it, and then it provides for the cap on the penalties. As
so
I already mentioned,
there was no consideration by the magistrate of her financial situation. There was no discussion of that whatsoever.
No, and the regs do not provide for that either. And the case law is very clear on that too, Your Honor.
I'm still in a tizzy over here on the right side, because the underlying violations question wasn't before the magistrate.
Right.
Then I don't understand why he has authority to review the amount. If it's not before him, how does he go around reviewing the amount?
He doesn't consider whether the violations occurred or not. He has to take that as a given, that the violations occurred, because she didn't appeal that.
Right.
Right. So then what she's appealing is the imposition of the monetary penalty at all. And the regs provide that there's a judicial review available, and his standard is arbitrary and capricious when he looks at the imposition of the civil monetary penalty. And I'm sorry if I'm not making it more clear, but I guess that's the clearest I can make it.
Well, it doesn't make sense to me, so I'm going to have to go back and figure it out.
Okay. And again, I apologize if I cannot make that more clear.
Well, I don't think anyone could, because if you don't have if the underlying violation isn't in front of him, how can the amount of the underlying violation be in front of him? It just doesn't make sense.
Okay.
But I may be missing something here. I don't know.
All right. Well, or perhaps I'm not explaining it well enough to your satisfaction. So basically, the issues raised in this appeal were a de novo review of the summary judgment, the court's finding that, in fact, a sale of the store occurred. The government has set forth in its brief and rests upon pretty much the arguments in its brief. I simply would like to add that the only thing opposing the government's proposed findings of fact was the affidavit submitted by Attorney Carson, and that there was no other affidavit or other proposal of facts, and in fact there were admissions that admitted to the sale of the store.
Right, it was in the request for admissions that she said there was a sale.
Right.
Because I wanted to clarify that.
Exactly, and also in the proposed findings of fact for the government, it was also a proposed finding of fact, and there were no competing proposed findings of fact. As you explore the record, you may note that Attorney Barry did file a motion to, in fact, strike the affidavit of Carson. That was not granted, but she did strike it as not being in compliance with not only the federal rules of civil procedure, but also the local rules of civil procedure. Not only the affidavit, but also the submission of the opposition brief, in that it does not propose alternative findings of fact, nor does it specifically deny or make any reference to the proposed findings of fact of the defendant. As to the civil monetary penalty, I will just again say is that this circuit has said where the sanction is within the prescribed range of the regulatory and statutory boundaries, the reviewing court may not find that the penalty imposed is arbitrary and capricious. In this case, the Food and Nutrition Service, on six violations that were found, imposed the maximum $11,000 on each violation. And although it's unclear in appellant's brief, I did address if, in fact, he is challenging the magistrate judge's denial of the Rule 59E motion. I did address that. That's under a review of abuse of discretion. And Rule 59E solely permits corrections to occur for to a manifest law or fact. And in this instance, what petitioner attempted to do through the Rule 59E was advance an argument that should or could have been raised in opposition to summary judgment and also was relitigating issues that had previously been litigated.
I was just curious because I can't recall right now this alleged the sale. What was the amount?
Of the sale?
Right.
If you give me a moment. I think it's 40-some thousand.
Yeah, that's what I thought. It was under $50,000 for the sale.
Right.
And then $66,000 for the penalty.
Penalty, yep.
It's a horrible case.
It is.
$44,000 was to be the ultimate sale price, yes.
Right. And so with respect to the government's position on this, does the government ever look at the equities in a situation like this? Because I assume the government could be heard on the penalty portion of this case. And I appreciate you were not trial counsel. But it certainly seems to me that's something that the government should have considered.
I can only speak from what I tangentially know about the case. It is going beyond the record. And that was, I believe, that negotiations were pursued and did not result in anything other than the filing of the motion for summary judgment. But that's, again, it's beyond the record, and
but
I was not
counsel.
But
am I right that the government does have a, can make recommendations to the magistrate with respect to what an appropriate penalty would be?
And conversely, the government could, I mean, the government is a loose term. I mean, the
right.
United States
no,
Attorney's
I
Office
mean,
could go to the Food and Nutrition Service. And I don't know for certain, again, it's beyond the record, but I believe that those, at least the food and nutrition aspect, was at least.
Well, we have no idea of whether or not, I mean, this court doesn't, and there's no way to know.
No, it's not in the record.
You haven't heard my question yet.
I'm sorry.
We have no idea what the prosecuting authorities, and I'm not asking you to respond to this, I'm just raising this for consideration, considered this a fraudulent sale or not. And that may well have impacted these apparent inequities that seem to be between sale price and penalty.
You are.
Is that a correct possibility?
Yes.
I don't want your commentary on whether that occurred, Ms. Warren. So there's the face of this court of this has one appearance, but there are other explanations, perhaps, that go into prosecutorial discretion, as well as reaching back to the agency. So just as one side believes there is no sale, it may very well be a view that this is a fraudulent sale in the eyes of prosecuting authorities.
Yes.
Thank you.
Does interest continue to grow on?
The 66,000? Mm-hmm. I don't believe so, but I don't know. If there are no further questions.
No.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Carson?
Thank you. Well,
it is true hard cases make bad law, but I really don't believe this is a bad law case, although it is certainly a hard luck case for Ms. Ezra-Mera. I don't believe that it is an exceedingly narrow range of review for Judge Callahan. I believe that Judge Callahan needs to consider, in compliance with the Corder versus United States case, the gravity of the offense, the size of the business, and the effect of penalty on the person's ability to continue in business.
And then this whole penalty issue, certainly you had an opportunity to comment.
Absolutely. The penalty was the maximum penalty. What I do not
and was there any discussion, as Judge Flom suggested, there are always two sides to the coin.
There was never any. I'm sorry, I'll let you
go
quit.
Ahead.
There was never any discussion. There was never anything raised between myself and Attorney Nora Sheehan Berry, or anybody to that matter, to my knowledge, that this was a fraudulent sale. Mr. Souza, by the way, I have to update you, has since died. Somebody else is, my client is apparently running a small liquor type outfit within that grocery store. She's not even really running the grocery store as of last week when I last found out.
She's the holder of a liquor license in the state?
Apparently, yes. That's all she has left. Nothing left. Nobody suggested this was a fraudulent sale. I appreciate your asking, but that was never raised by the government. They just simply imposed the maximum. I would just respectfully submit to the court, if we were to adopt the view that this is an agency determination and Judge Callahan does not have the ability to review it, we were essentially saying that the government, the Department of Agriculture, gets a blank check, or gets a carte blanche, I should say, is a better phrase, carte blanche, to say, we just think, out of sheer complacency, out of sheer, laziness, we're just going to impose upon you the maximum, because we feel like it. No other reason than we feel like it. That clearly runs counter to our notions of justice. And that is why there is a standard review. I don't believe it's arbitrary and capricious. I think it's the quarter standards. But even if it was arbitrary and capricious, it doesn't help advance the purpose of that statute to whack Ms. Estramera with $66,000. And if I could just lastly point out, I do believe that Attorney Sheehan, Judge Callahan, rightfully admitted my affidavit. It was, according to the government's own site, Popovitz versus Circuit City, which accepted an affidavit of an attorney and found it to be creating a material fact in dispute, by the way. I believe that my affidavit, while I would have preferred it, I would have done it differently if I could have done it over again. I still think it is valid. It creates a valid issue of material fact as to the whether the sale occurred.
Thank you, Mr. Carson.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Warwick.
No other questions?
No, I'm sorry. Do you have a question?
No.